Cycles.
What if I just, instead of giving out the talk of text line, just started giving up Robin Voss's number all the time? Cycles. 844-96 party. What is it?
Write it down. 608-237-9163. Call now.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time, this is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin!
Who do you think is to blame for the student loan crisis? Is it schools? Is it banks? Is it the government? Is it the students themselves? I ask because there is a survey out that asked young Americans who they think is responsible for student loans not being forgiven. And basically right now, that survey says they're piling the blame on their student debt balances on conservatives, largely the Supreme Court. And this was a survey poll done by Generation Lab and provided exclusively to Axios. And so, but I feel like those are two different questions. There's a question of who's blaming whom for the lack of student loan forgiveness versus a question about how did we get in this mess in the first place? And so I would love to hear from you more on the latter of when you think about the fact that there are tens of millions of borrowers in the U.S., who collectively owe more than $1 trillion. Why did this happen? 844-967-2789. That's 844-96-PARTY. I certainly don't blame the students themselves because I don't think you see that. It's like blaming all the people who took the crappy mortgages in the lead up to the housing crisis in 2008 and saying, well, you should have been smarter. You should have known that was a bad loan. And I feel like it's just interesting to think because, you know, the problem with asking the question that the survey asked is I think there's a lot of people who don't think student loans should be forgiven at all. And so there is no blame to be had, but interested to hear from you. Who do you think is to blame for the student loan crisis? 844-967-2789. But as far as that that survey goes, 47% said the Supreme Court was responsible. This is for student loan, the lack of student loan forgiveness. 38% said the Republicans were responsible. 10% said Biden was responsible. And 5% said Democrats were responsible. So I thought that was interesting to think potentially what that could mean for 2024. Jane Madner, what do you think?
Wow. I understand not wanting to blame the students entirely because, again, understanding interest and what that's going to mean down the road. But I think you make a good point about the housing crisis, the mortgage crisis leading up to the crash in 2008, where, like you said, they knew they were the people who were selling these mortgages knew they were bad, right? And so it's tough.
But here's the thing. So in what situation does a bank give an 18-year-old a loan to start a business without a solid business plan?
Good point. I mean, isn't the whole lending screwed up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, all of that screwed up as far as like one, there's like predatory loans. There's the fact that the interest rates can't be, and like you can refinance your house, but you can't refinance your student loans.
Right.
And the fact, and you can also never file for bankruptcy. And so that's where it comes into the government and the fact of like how they've decided to set up these loans that are so different from everything else that we do when it comes to the banking system. There's the fact that when it comes to public schools, at least in Wisconsin, how much of the share of publicly funded schools are not being publicly funded. So then thus the tuitions go up. There's the fact that student, like the colleges themselves are becoming more expensive because of administrator, like how like the administrators and how much like they spend on their marketing in a new building in order to be competitive and try to attract more students. And so this would mean there's a lot of blame to go around. And I just don't know if it's as much about personal responsibility than laying squarely at the feet of tens of millions of people who were told you have to go to college if you want to
be successful. Yep. 844-967-2789-844-96-PARTY. Karina from Milwaukee. Good morning, Karina. What do you think?
Good morning, guys. I'm lucky enough. I've been into two different educational systems. I was as a student and I was as an instructor. And I tell you this, education of your people, it's an investment. You see, it's investment. It's investment mm-hmm. in your people, in your future education. Not making a business out of it. Not earning interest on the loans. I give you an example. In Russia, right? Because I don't know any other system what have a national education. And actually, while I was listening to you, I would probably go back and look how Britain or France or any other country who's offering national education, how did they got to this point? I don't know. But I know how it's happening in Russia because of the revolution. Now, look, this is a different mentality. In Russia, because you spend money for a future, for your kids. And those kids picking up profession and trying to figure out what they can be best at for government money, because the government is the ultimate parent, right? Ultimate taking care of, ultimately responsible for the country because we pay our government taxes to do that for us. So basically, when you are in the higher education in Russia, you have, first of all, it's free. Secondary, when you're in school like 8 to 10 hours, it's your working day practically. And everybody consider you a working person when you are in the college. Government also will pay you statements depending on your grades. So you don't have to look for a work and pay attention to your education.
That's interesting.
In this country, education is something what would be used for a future, your future, right? So mm-hmm. when you go to college, they're telling you, well, you can get this job. This is what's going to pay you this. This is the job that's going to pay you that. And when you're taking a loan, it's obvious that you will be able to pay it off. Well, the thing is, if the system would be adjusted to loans and salaries, then it's a possible. There is a question, why are we doing that when we can offer free education? We have enough money. If we're giving $3 billion to Ukraine, we have enough money to offer at least a half a part of national education as well as the health care to invest in your future. This government do not invest in their people. This government doesn't want smart and healthy population. They want dumb and sick. And this is why it's coming from the conservative and Republicans, because you can see what they're doing. They're removing
absolutely
money from education. They're removing thanks so much money for the, from healthcare.
Thanks so much for the call, Karina. I agree as far as the investment in your people. And, you know, so many European countries, it is an actual public education if you choose to keep going. And so it sounds like, at least from Karina's point of view, this is something that the government of putting the financial burden as far as it's your investment. And again, it comes back to, I think, the ethos of individualism and personal responsibility that we have in this country. But collectively, I don't know if it's working out. What do you think? 844-967-2789.
Jack from Merrimack. Good morning, Jack. What do you want to say?
Good morning. Well, over the years, probably since around 1980 and Reagan's "the government isn't the answer, the government's the problem" philosophy, Republicans, and it's been primarily Republicans, have cut back in support for all kinds of public education. The universities have been public universities, that is to say, state colleges and state universities have been particularly hard hit. I'm an old guy, but I remember thinking when I was in college, oh, this is great. A person could live on $1,000 a year, go to school full time. It's a wonderful system. When my son graduated from a UW system school, just the tuition alone was close to $50,000. Now, I can understand easily how a person could end up working full-time during the summer and even part-time during the school year and still end up with $20,000, $30,000 or more dollars in debt. And that isn't the main UW-Madison school. That's one of the UW system schools. Madison was closer to $75,000. So that's the situation that we've been put in by this individual responsibility thing. In other words, don't let the government support anything that benefits anybody except the billionaires. Sorry, but that's kind of the way it is.
No, I totally understand. Thanks so much for the call, Jack. But we would love to hear from you as well, as far as who is to blame mostly, because there's probably a lot of blame to go around, for the fact that tens of millions of people owe more than $1 trillion just in student loans in this country. Can it all be summed up to personal responsibility, or is it the combination of government decisions, the banks, how the schools themselves? 844-967-2789. We will take your texts, take your calls, take your comments on the live stream when we come back. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Don't you know I'll always be your thing?
Gee, I'll go thank the dean.
Hey, you're the one who signed your life away.
Yeah, when I was 17, I couldn't comprehend my fate, much less define an interest rate. I wish it was a foreign debate, but now it's fine.
Oh, it really was so great. I made a lot of friends and I went on a few dates. Now I'm getting married, man. Wow, that is so cool. But I wish I could spend on my wife the money spent for school.
Yeah, we all got loans, buddy.
When I was a young boy, I thought that school was free.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Madnair. Did you have some fun finding some of these songs this morning?
I did. There are a number of songs about school loans.
Well, as we've said, it is probably indicative because of there's that many songs and parody songs written about it, because it is a big problem that a lot of people are stuck with. And I'm asking, I mean, obviously this is a big existential question that is not going to get solved in two segments of this radio show, but I am interested because there is a survey, as far as I think there's going to be political ramifications based on that survey, of who young people are blaming for the lack of student loan forgiveness. And it was by Generation Lab and provided to Axios, and I was reading about it this morning. And basically, between the Supreme Court and Republicans, it's like 85%.
Wow.
Well, not 85. So it's 47% the Supreme Court, 38% Republicans, and only 15% between Biden and the Democrats. And so, I think there's a lot of people out there who don't think any blame, because there was a lot of people who were really upset about the original proposal from Biden that got overturned by the Supreme Court, and who did not think that they should have to, their taxes should bail out people who had student loans. And so I'm more interested in, I guess whom I get, you know, there's probably a debate to be had if you think it's a crisis whatsoever, but it's hard to look at that number and think that it's not a problem. Maybe a crisis is escalated, but who you think is to blame for it? Like how we got in this mess. And I guess to a certain extent, who's responsible for fixing it then? 844-967-2789. We have a couple comments on the live stream. One from Tony Zimmerman. We need to revamp the higher education to be a little more like Germany, where apprenticeships are used more. So many jobs just retrain students to do things the company wants anyway. I think that's true. I think there's a lot of skills. Like I try to think about what I studied in college, and I defend my major. I defend the things that I learned there and how it helped me throughout my career. But most of my first job out of school was cold calling and being able to like navigate Salesforce.com, which I certainly did not learn in school. I got another one from Josh Egan. It's a broken system. The cost to attend has skyrocketed the last 20 years. The government loan amount with a reasonable interest rate is minuscule, so people have to go out and get private bank loans. Those rates are so much higher, and that's where the problem arises. Factor in people who maybe chose a school that they really couldn't afford and could have gone somewhere for the same degree for far less. So everyone has a bit of the blame to shoulder.
844-967-2789 if you want to check in. John from the Falls, good morning. To be honest, there's plenty of blame to go around. Everyone is at least partly responsible to one degree or another. That being said, I've heard some students are paying 9% interest on student loans, and those loans are exempt from bankruptcy forgiveness. Let's at least be fair and say that if business owners and everyday Americans can have their debts wiped out by bankruptcy protection, students with loans should have the same protections. I honestly think the best way around all of this is to cut out the bank middleman and have the government directly issue loans to students at 0% interest, since as a country, we need people with the skills to make our economy and our lives better. Also, if we're going to let people and businesses get away with not paying back their PPP loans, there's no reason we shouldn't be doing debt forgiveness for people that have gone to college.
And I think that's the thing where I get hung up, both on the original proposal but from Biden, because to me, it always just felt like a Band-Aid. And until you actually solve the structural problem of there's always going to be a new wave of students, that number, that like actual quantitative number of how many people are going to go to college is going to go up and down, but there are people who are going to continue to go and continue to take out loans. And until you change the actual like structure of how those loans are financed, who it's just, you know, you just paid off some people's without actually fixing the problem. And so that was always my problem with the solution as it was, is it didn't change anything as far as the actual process goes. And even the new plan that seems to have gotten a lot less pushback, granted, it's like the difference between $400 billion and $40 billion. But I mean, last Friday, Biden basically put out a plan B and said he's going to alleviate $39 billion of debt for 800,000 borrowers, which is a much smaller proposal than the original one. But seemingly, at least from what I've read, it hasn't been nearly the same kind of pushback at all. And I don't know if like the details of it is because it's so much smaller that people just don't have as much of a problem with it. And there's not the same kind of like immediate amount of lawsuits of like that you can't do this and we're going to take you to court. But it seems like a lot less pushback. But again, it's certainly helping the people who have the loans right now, but I don't see the effort to change how it's structured from anybody. Like we keep debating about what to do with the debt that exists, but not to how to curb future debt.
844-967-2789. Tom from LA. Tom, we only got a minute. Go ahead.
All right, real quick. Kristen, who is the government?
We are the government, Tom.
Okay. So we the people are the government because we pay taxes into the government. Okay? So therefore, what happened was we the people lost government when Citizens United, Buckley versus Vallejo, and First National Bank versus Bilotti came along and made it where politicians could be bought off by big corporations and pay from a 70% tax back in Eisenhower's day to down to 15%.
Tom, we got to let you go. We're coming up against the break.
All right. Thanks for the call, Tom, as always. When we come back, Dan Schaefer is here to recombobulate specifically about highway deconstruction. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Man, we didn't care. Time to make a payment. Instead, we both forbear.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere. What were you just listening to, Jane?
That is called Discombobulation.
Ah. By Hans Zimmer. Yes. There we go. We might have found Dan Schaefer's new theme song for every week when he joins on Tuesdays to recombobulate with Discombobulate by Hans Zimmer.
I've got a new walk-up song. This is pretty great. It's like I'm walking the plate.
Have you heard that one before?
I have not, no.
It's from Sherlock Holmes, the movie.
Okay.
The one with Jude Law?
Yes.
And okay.
Yep, and all Robert right. Downey Jr., yes.
It's bouncy.
That's a deep cut, Jane. I like
mischievous.
It.
Yeah. Dan Schaefer, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
So I'm excited, as someone who lives in Milwaukee, I'm excited to have this conversation. I'm also cognizant that this is a very Milwaukee topic. And so trying to keep it high level in the theme of, I think, like how communities are built or change over time, because this is something that's not unique to Milwaukee in the fact that like public input, big decisions, big infrastructure decisions. And of course, what I'm talking about is the conversation around tearing down I-794, which is the strip of highway that basically goes directly into some of the Summerfest grounds and cuts through downtown. And now yesterday there was another meeting. I don't know how many people were there. I know you and Isaac and Urbanist Twitter was there.
Urbanist Twitter was well represented at this event yesterday that was held at Marquette University. It was a kind of morning long event talking about 794 and also reflecting on the city's history with tearing down freeways with the Park East Freeway from about 20 years ago. So Peter Park, who was part of Mayor John Norquist's administration and who really kind of led the effort to tear down the Park East Freeway, was there kind of as the keynote speaker and reflecting on, you know, removing that Park East Freeway, which for those who might not remember that time in Milwaukee, it was a freeway that essentially went right through where Fiserv Forum is now and kind of emptied out.
Yeah.
On the east side where you have the Pick and Save at East Point Commons and Points East Pub and a few other notable places that people even outside of Milwaukee might recognize. So it was basically a fast track to the supermarket. People lost their minds over it. They're saying it was going to ruin the city. It didn't. It opened up acres and acres of developable land. And now what we have there is Fiserv Forum and the Deer District, Trade Hotel, all sorts of different things. So removing a freeway and developing it to benefit the city is kind of the basic concept here. And they're talking about how to, you know, apply the lessons learned there to 794, because I think, as Park mentioned in his comments, does anybody miss the Park East Freeway? Did it really make a difference for congestion in Milwaukee? Not really. So basically what we're talking about now is removing that stretch of 794 that basically goes between the Marquette Interchange and the lakefront and kind of sits right in between downtown and the Third Ward. And this is, you know, really when you zoom out and think about it, this is some of the most valuable land in the state. You know, it's right between Milwaukee River and Lake Michigan, right between downtown and the Third Ward. These are some of the fastest growing parts of the city, but we have this big freeway kind of running through it. And as the presenters really talked about, in the event yesterday, this is mostly a freeway that is used as an extended on-ramp. There are many other ways to get on 94 going west or get on the Hone Bridge to head south. This effort would not impact the Hone Bridge at all. I think that's been a point of confusion for a lot of people as this rollout has been unveiled. But, you know, it would really open up a lot of land to really do something differently in downtown Milwaukee.
So who would ultimately, who does this big of a decision, because it is a big decision, come down to? As like who needs to be involved and what would need to be approved for this to actually move forward?
Yeah, this would involve levels of multiple levels of government to make this decision. And it would in large part be driven by the State Department of Transportation. And the State Department of Transportation has put out designs with a number of options. And so if you look at if you look at their website, you can kind of take a look through the 794 things. There's an option to kind of replace it as is. There's an option to improve it and keep that connection to the Hone Bridge. And then there's the option to remove the freeway entirely. The Hone Bridge would essentially just end where it does, right along the lakefront at Michigan Avenue there. And so there are going to be public involvement meetings coming up right at the beginning of August, August 1st and 2nd in Milwaukee, to talk about, you know, what people might want to see with this freeway. And, you know, I think as we've talked about at the recombobulation area, the effort to convert the stadium freeway to a boulevard, and that effort is ongoing. That study is ongoing. We will see some sort of renderings or proposals for that this fall. You know, on the east end of town here, we've got this 794 debate really heating up. And I think this is a really, really interesting one to think about, you know, how the built environment is going to work in that part of Milwaukee going forward.
We're talking to Dan Schaefer for our weekly segment of Recombobulating with Dan Schaefer every Tuesday. And today we're talking, at least starting with the conversation around tearing down the 794 freeway that leads basically right to the lakefront. And so it comes down to the State Department or the State Department of Transportation. Through my echo chamber, I definitely hear all the arguments of why we should do this. I see some of the examples of it looking like a boulevard and the different things that could be developed down there and the different like walkability that gets created between, you know, basically where the third Street Avenue market, like Market Hall and Public Market is now, and that whole strip becoming a lot more walkable. It would mean there's no more pickleball courts by the Public Market maybe the pickleball people.
That's going to end it right there, the pickleball.
But I guess, what is the opposition to it? And does it, if you're thinking objectively, does it have any legs?
Well, I think some of the opposition that we've seen from it has been from communities south of downtown who enjoy the Hone Bridge connection to I-94 there. I think, you know, we've seen some mayors from South Milwaukee or Cudahy or some of those south suburban communities that say, hey, we don't want to lose our connection to the Hone. And I think there has been some confusion about how this would impact the Hone Bridge. Some people are saying, why would you tear down the Hone Bridge? Well, that's not what this is proposing. I think there's still a little bit of confusion over what exactly this is. But I think, you know, some people do really like the convenience of being able to get around through the highways there. But I think one of the interesting points that came up from the speech from Peter Park at the event yesterday was really reflecting on the very beginning of the interstate highway system when the Eisenhower administration back in the 50s implemented this process. They were talking about using it to connect cities and not go through cities. And I think there were so many decisions that followed when the country was really building all of these highways and interstates all over the place, so many of these highways cut through cities, and so many of these highways cut through cities in communities of color too. And I think that really, there's a lot of history with that in Milwaukee, particularly with I-43, really destroying a lot of the earliest, black neighborhoods in the city of Milwaukee. And I think that is an important part of this conversation too, that was not really the original vision of the interstate highway system. It was going from city to city, not through cities, right?
That's super interesting to think about. And because is there other cities, like, as someone who's lived in multiple big cities. Like LA certainly has a lot of LA is also huge. It has a lot of freeways through the city. Manhattan does not, mostly just because you can't, and it's basically up and down either side of the island. And I'm trying to think, San Francisco.
That was one really example either? Used. They had like that double decker freeway that was kind of along the water there, and they removed that, and now it's just like the part of the waterfront that you associate with San Francisco.
Yeah.
And so they did have like kind of a freeway removal there. A similar thing in Seattle where they removed a freeway next to the water. That is a very new project, so hard to see exactly what's happening with that. But there, one of the examples that they talked about as well is just there's no example of a freeway getting built through a city and it improving the neighborhoods that it's built through. Like it just absolutely ravages these neighborhoods when you build a freeway through it. So I think, you know, part of it is reversing the mistakes of the past, but part of it is, you know, examining a more compelling future and that would, you know, give people options, not just by car getting there with transit and bikes and pedestrians and all sorts of different things. And this is a part of Milwaukee that has grown significantly. Like the downtown Walker's Point east side part of the city has grown. I think one of the statistics that they shared yesterday, it has grown almost 25% in the last decade. And so that, you know, Milwaukee is losing population, but I think that part of the city went from like 30,000 population to like a 37,000-38,000 population. That's a pretty significant increase in a decade. You know, this is part of the city that is really growing rapidly. And, you know, you want to leverage that growth and that opportunity by, you know, opening up more land. And Milwaukee really needs to build more housing. The state of Wisconsin in general needs to build more housing. There is a, you know, really low vacancy rates in Milwaukee and Madison that, you know, compares to a lot of these coastal cities that are having a lot of housing crunches now too. So this would open the opportunity to build more housing. And we're seeing a lot of, you know, stuff happening downtown where we're converting old office buildings to housing as well. We really, really have an opportunity to build more housing that will, you know, bring rents down, give more people some more opportunities. And I think that can be really a benefit for the city as a whole.
Eric from Tosa checking in on the text line, take down 794 and rebuild Milwaukee. I lived off Brady near the Park East Freeway and I haven't missed it since. But that is one criticism that I've heard, Dan, is that when they took down the Park East and they opened up that land, yes, but it took 10 to 15 years where it basically sat vacant until Fiserv Forum came along.
It did, but we did have a global financial recession in that period as well. So they took it down, what was it, 2003 that they finally took it down, and then they didn't get the Bucks Arena to really kind of commit to being part of it until, you know, 2014, 15 or so. But right in the middle of that, I think they had plans to develop it in the middle of that, but those were kind of scuttled by the, you know, the Bush era financial collapse. So I think that's an important part of the context for how long it took to build something there as well.
It's interesting just to end on this. And then when we come back, I want to talk because there is a special election today. So we'll get to that after the break. But one thing I just would love your input on is someone who is very, very pro Milwaukee and very involved in so many of the conversations that happen around the evolution of the city. Our mutual friend, Isaac Rowlett, tweeted this out this morning, and I just wanted to get your reaction from it. It says, we don't talk enough about how many of the most powerful people in our cities actually live in the suburbs. And no judgment, that's totally their choice. I just wish we did a better job prioritizing perspectives of city residents in decisions we make about our cities. And do you think that's unique to Milwaukee as far as how many of our business leaders, you know, there's also loopholes as far as having two addresses. Like, I think we all know that when Bob Donovan ran, he was actually also living in Glendale or Greendale. And so, like, just as before we go to the break, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think, you know, we see a lot of, especially I think leaders in the business community, you know, who are residents of the suburbs and have a lot to say about the city of Milwaukee. And one of the points that one of the leaders on the panel yesterday from Milwaukee Department of Development was saying that one of the top comments that they saw in this process for their downtown plan was, we need to plan for Milwaukee for Milwaukeeans. We need to do this for Milwaukeeans and not just make it 2 minutes easier and make your 2-minute commute from the suburbs that much easier. So I think you really need to, we need to really be focusing on Milwaukeeans when we plan for Milwaukee.
I agree. All right. Well, when we come back, Dan Schaefer will still be here to recombobulate on today's special election and maybe what the tea leaves say, depending on what the results are. So stay tuned. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinair, and we are doing our weekly segment with Dan Schaefer, where we recombobulate, because that is the name of his Substack, Recombobulation Area. Is that how you're describing it now? Is it still an online weekly column? I feel like it's so much more than that.
Yeah, weekly column and online publication is the way I'm characterizing. I need to
sometimes podcast.
Sometimes podcast and sometimes other things.
And
Milwaukee Press Club Award winner for best blog. So I don't know if maybe it's just a blog. Maybe it's just a blog.
There's something so pedestrian around the word of just calling it a blog, especially because you've won Milwaukee Press Club, 10 times now?
For the recombobulation area, I've had 10 awards. Yes.
Yes. So, but you should subscribe. If you are not already subscribed to the recombobulation area, you should go ahead and do that. It's only $5 a month.
$5 a month. Yep.
And it's a latte.
We even love our free subscribers too. Most of our content is free. Making that $5 a month commitment is just saying that you support our work and you want to help us grow and support independent media in Milwaukee and Wisconsin.
Absolutely. All right. Well, you had a tweet thread this morning. Was it also an IG or was it also a Meta thread?
Not yet. I'll make it over there eventually. Zuckerberg can wait.
Copy and paste. About today's special election, which has gotten not a ton of attention. So, but it's still important. And I think I would love to just hear in the time that we have what you think today's results could tell us going into next year.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting race, because if you look back a couple of years ago, in 2020, the race for the 24th Assembly District was one of the most competitive in the state. And incumbent Representative Dan Knodel won re-election by just over 1,000 votes. And he was against Democrat Emily Segrist. It was less than 2% margin. But then redistricting happened. And redistricting really changed the makeup of this district significantly. It went from one that was, you know, kind of a Republican-leaning competitive district to one where the Republicans had a huge, huge double-digit 20-point advantage. And that's what happened in the 2022 election when Dan Knodel was reelected. He won by a margin of more than 20 points, 20%. But then he, of course, went on to run for the open state Senate district. So people in Grafton and Menominee Falls and Germantown have really been voting in legislative races quite a bit.
I know.
In this last year, you know, thinking back to the midterm last year, the special election that was a part of the spring ballot, and now this one. So a lot of voting if you live in Grafton or Germantown or a number of these district communities that make up this district. But I think this is, you know, just yet another test case for kind of shifting political leanings, the political dynamics of the WOW counties. This is the district that includes pieces of Ozaukee, Washington, and Waukesha County. So as those counties have continued to shift to the left, and significantly so in the spring election, you know, it's going to be interesting to see if this will again be another 20-point margin of victory for Republicans, or if Democrats can narrow that gap, or even pull off something really unexpected. You know, it's a special election. Who knows what might happen? But you know, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens here because of the shifts happening.
Absolutely. And also, I read this morning. I thought I heard this, but then I read it and confirmed it. The Democrat is outraised the Republican in the race. And so Bob Tatterson has reported $103,000 raised in, I think, the last reporting period versus the Republican, Paul Melotyk, is closer to like half that. So that's that's interesting to me.
Yeah, it's going to be a factor. I think, you know, it's going to be, you know, even if the Tatterson doesn't win here, like, this is going to be an election that's going to be on the ballot next fall. That, you know, the recombobulation area will surely preview, along with the 100 plus other races on the ballot for the state legislature. So I think, you know, even if the Democrat doesn't do the unexpected and pull off the upset here, this is about building long term infrastructure for political change. And it's important to show up in every election. If it's a double digit margin, let's get it to a single digit margin for next time. Every election matters, and it's all about building that momentum for the long term.
Absolutely. All right. Well, looking forward and now moving to looking back, you have an event on Friday, this Friday, right?
This coming Friday at the Cooperage, the Recombobulation Area and Milwaukee Record are joining forces once again to rewatch the 2021 NBA Finals Game 6. We're just going to make it an annual event and celebrate
there
it every year. It's the greatest moment in Milwaukee sports history.
Never forget.
It's the only finals to happen in the middle of summer. So we're just going to celebrate it every year. We're just going to celebrate Giannis scoring 50 points and bringing the championship home to Milwaukee every year. And so it's a free event at the Cooperage on Friday. Come relive the greatest moment in Milwaukee sports history. You're laughing at me.
I'm laughing because it's, I love all of you guys. I love Milwaukee Record. I love you. I love that we won 2 years ago, but I'm also just like, how many years in a row are you going to do this before it becomes like a little sad?
Every year, Kristen, we're going to do it every year. It's going to be an annual event. We're going to rewatch Giannis making those free throws. Making his darn free throws in that game. We're going to watch it every year. It's not going to get old. It's not old yet.
But there is like parts of this. And I honestly, if we weren't going out of town this weekend, I'd probably still come just because I would be excited to see like friends who are probably going to go. But there is a little bit of it that like high school quarterback keeps watching his like high school games, even though he's 35.
True. There's a little bit of element to that. But you know what? It's the only Milwaukee professional sports championship of my lifetime.
Fair.
So we are going to celebrate it. It is not off until the Bucks win again, which, you know, fingers crossed for next season with a new coach and all that. Maybe the next year we will be celebrating two championships
when we
do this goofy event in the middle of summer next year.
I love it. All right, Dan Schaefer, thank you so much for joining us. As always, we'll have you back next week at the same time. And for now, we're going to take a break for the top of the hour news. But when we come back, talking about a new recycling technique that could help keep flexible plastics out of landfills. We're going to be talking to UW-Madison engineering professor George Huber. So stick around for that conversation. This is As Goes Wisconsin.